Hello, it is Ryan, and we could all use an extra bright spot in our day, couldn't we? Just to make up for things like sitting in traffic, doing the dishes, counting your steps, you know, all the mundane stuff. That is why I'm such a big fan of Chumba Casino. Chumba Casino has all your favorite social casino style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere with daily bonuses. That should brighten your day a little. Actually, a lot. So sign up now at chumbacasino.com. That's ChumbaCasino.com. No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where
prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus. Judy was boring.
Hello.
Then Judy discovered ChumbaCasino.com.
It's my little escape.
Now Judy's the life of the party.
Oh, baby. Mama's bringing home the bacon.
Whoa. Take it easy, Judy. The Chumba life is for everybody. So go to ChumbaCasino.com and play over 100 casino-style games. Join today and play for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. ChumbaCasino.com. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
If you're snacking on anything but tasty cake, you're making a huge Miss Cake. A fistful of chocolate-covered raisins? Miss Cake. A spoonful of peanut butter? Bigger Miss Cake. Or the worst Miss Cake of all, your kid's Halloween candy, and it's April. If it's not tasty cake, it's a Miss Cake, because nothing satisfies like a perfectly sweet butterscotch crimpet or rich and creamy chocolate peanut butter candy cake. Tasty cake, except no substitute.
Hey everybody, and welcome to the Billboard.com Pop Shop Podcast. My name is Keith Caulfield, and I am the co-director of charts at Billboard. Joining me, as always, is Billboard Deputy Editor Digital, Katie Atkinson. Hello, Katie.
Hey, Keith.
How are you?
Doing great.
Well, you know, we're celebrating a pair of 20-year anniversaries of albums today on the show that have a very international flair. But what could we possibly mean by that? Well, stay tuned and we'll tell you in just a second, because the Billboard Pop Shop Podcast is your one-stop shop for all things pop and sing-songy bits from me on Billboard's weekly charts. In addition, you can always count on a lively discussion about the latest pop news, fun chart stats and stories, new music, and guest interviews with music stars and folks from the world of pop.
Today on the show, we've got Coming Around Again with Billboard.com Senior Associate Editor Andrew Unterberger. Andrew will be discussing the 20th anniversary of two albums this week, Robin's Robin Is Here and Wyclef Jean's The Carnival. Andrew is joined by writers Dan Weiss and Chris Martins to talk about the two albums respectively.
But first, before we get started, if you enjoy the podcast, subscribe to the show on iTunes so you won't miss an episode, and give us a rating or review while you're at it. If you have any questions for us, feel free to tweet us at Keith_Caulfield or at KT Atkinson. And if you want to explore more podcasts from Billboard, visit iTunes.com/Billboard Podcasts. So, you know, Katie, here's a fun fact. Last year, I actually visited the location of where portions of Robin's album that Andrew will be talking about was recorded at.
Ooh.
Sharon Studio. I actually looked up, hopefully I'm pronouncing that correctly, because it looks a little bit different from the way it sounds. Sharon Studio in Stockholm, Sweden.
A lot of Swedish hits have been recorded there, yeah, I'm assuming.
It's the home of Max, well, it's the former home of Max Martin, and where Dennis Pop, the late Dennis Pop, recorded a lot of their hits in sort of the mid-90s. I didn't actually get to go inside the studio. I just got to see the outside of it because it's no longer a studio.
Right.
But it's the place where Robin's Show Me Love and tracks by Britney and NSYNC and Ace of Base and Backstreet were all recorded there. So at one point or another, this building housed all of those artists coming in and out the door.
A lot of star power.
It's pretty amazing.
Well, we'll definitely hear all about Robin's Robin Is Here. Definitely worth checking out, in addition to the rest of Robin's catalog. And Wyclef's The Carnival today on Coming Around Again. Always be around.
Hello, and welcome to Coming Around Again, Billboard's anniversary theme podcast dealing with milestone anniversaries in the music world. Today we're talking about an album that introduced one of the great pop talents the last couple decades, and that's Robin's Robin Is Here. Now, as is often the case with albums that we're talking about here on Coming Around Again, we're dealing with multiple release dates from multiple regions, so it's kind of it's a little sketchy as to when we're actually celebrating that anniversary. You know, the album came out in Europe in October of 1995, but we're jumping forward from that a couple of years to June of 1997, June 21st, when the album was released in the U.S. And to hear to talk about the 20th anniversary of that release, we have freelance writer Dan Weiss. What's up, Dan?
Hi, what's up?
So, Dan, you wrote something really good for us, kind of addressing this first Robin album within the context of like how clear it was from this one album that she was going to go on to become, you know, Robin, the kind of the cult pop star that we know her as today. And you know, in your intro, you talk about this album. You kind of refer to it as a blip, and I don't think you really mean that derisively, but it's just that well, this album was out, and you know, maybe you knew about it, maybe you didn't. It was there, but it wasn't unignorable.
Right. I mean, the idea of even thinking about listening to her album, it's not even necessarily like a knock on Robin. It's just that there were so many. 1997 was a huge year for songs by acts that came out of nowhere in all different styles. Mm-hmm. You know, you had like Swing, you had Hanson, you had everyone. So you know, having a teen pop star come out sort of pre-Britney and in the midst of Backstreet Boys and such, you know, and she's got one name, and you know, it's even if you like the song, it just doesn't seem like necessarily, you know, the song "Show Me Love." It just didn't seem pertinent to get around to listening to her album. So I didn't even hear it for almost 20 years, possibly. And yeah, it's really good. But I feel like I don't feel bad about not knowing that in 1997 because who was around to kind of tell us to listen to this minor pop star's album?
Yeah, that's fair, I think. I mean, I remember personally I sort of had the same impression of Robin as an 11-year-old, which was that, yeah, she's fine. She had two very big hits in Do You Know What It Takes and Show Me Love. Those are both Billboard Hot 100 mm-hmm. Top 10 hits. They were on MTV all the time. I'm sure if TRL had been around back then, they would have been major on TRL. But yeah, they didn't really add up to stardom in the way we might kind of have thought. Like if you were introduced to Robin 10 years later and you knew that she had these mega hits, you would think, oh, well, she must have been like really huge back then. And she kind of was, but not really. She was there. She was part of the landscape. But yeah, she wasn't really on that level where like you had to even have an opinion about her. I couldn't even tell you what I thought about Robin in 1997 because the songs were there, but they just didn't really like jump out at you in such a way. I mean,
right, exactly. Yeah, I didn't really think to even have an opinion on Robin until her Second Wind or whatever. But listening back, I mean, the hits were more enduring than I guess I thought at the time, which is a weird paradox, you know?
Yeah. And the interesting thing about listening to the album now is that, you know, you think of Robin as this kind of like, you know, glamorous Swedish disco diva, and you know she has these really like barnstorming pop singles, and she just feels really massive and really dance floor oriented. But you listen to the album, and it basically sounds like an R&B album. You know, I guess the fact that the album was technically released in 1995 first, which was sort of pre, you know, the kind of the big pop takeover of 1997 with, you know, like you know, the Cardigans and Hanson and Spice Girls and Aqua and stuff like that. So there wasn't really that mold necessarily for her to be what she would eventually become. So what there was for her was to basically sound like a Total album or a 702 album.
Yeah. I mean, it's interesting that it was actually from 95 or so, because, I mean, I was just kind of like reacquainting myself with some of the deep cuts. And a song like Just Another Girlfriend on the album has this kind of atmospheric but also like gritty beat, and it sounds like it could have been on like Biggie's Life After Death. He could have rapped over that track.
Yeah, it's kind of G-funk,
yeah, like on a Mary J. Blige album, or possibly maybe one of the less slick songs on Mariah's I guess Butterfly was the album that year. So yeah, the other thing, it's really interesting. I think that what's so interesting about it is how pop has evolved to the point that it's surprising to us that a very R&B indebted pop album from you know, that's a surprise to us, if that makes sense.
Yeah, that's fair. Like you think back in 1995 where this album was technically released, and you know, probably the biggest pop album that year, or at least one of them, was TLC's Crazy Sexy Cool. You know, I think that came out in late 94, but it certainly carried over well into 95. And that kind of was the mold for pop music at the time. And there, you know, you had dance pop one hit wonders, you know, people like, you know, like Nicki French doing Total Eclipse of the Heart or Everything But the Girl's Missing, stuff like that. But if you were to, those weren't really templates for stardom. Those were templates for like just getting on radio at all costs. But yeah, you flash forward to 20 years later, and there really isn't that TLC mold these days. It's either pop or it's explicitly hip hop. There's not that kind of middle ground, which is where Robin was trying to live back in those days.
Right, right. And TLC is definitely the thing that I was thinking of when I was revisiting this album. Show Me Love itself is kind of this, it's almost the exact midpoint between, I forget if like Rodney Jerkins or whoever actually produced Waterfalls, but, but it's got that, that, you know, sort of coming down from New Jack Swing thing where Waterfalls was, you know, one of the last R&B songs to have like horns in it, you know?
Right, yeah.
And Show Me Love also kind of has like wah guitar and horns and all these kind of like last vestiges of funk still in there. But at the same time, it also has that signature early Max Martin sound that that ended up being more defined by Britney's Baby One More Time, Oops, I Did It Again, where it's got this kind of, trying to think of the best way to describe this, I guess a staccato kind of beat where you have a guitar or piano element that's just kind of like clinking away, and you've got some like you know, eventually you started adding like slap bass to that, and it just has it feels almost like I said, like the exact middle between the TLC style and the Britney style, which is really interesting.
Yeah, and even if you mentioned Max Martin, and he certainly is a name that's well eclipsed even Robin in terms of, you know, legacies that start sort of with this album and with this moment in time. But even look at some of the stuff that he and his, some of his compatriots did on the first Backstreet Boys album. And even that is much more R&B indebted than we probably realize looking back on it. I mean, they basically wanted to be boys to men. There wasn't, there wasn't really like that boy band model yet within like the pop context.
Yeah, I mean, it's telling that, you know, Backstreet Boys, one of the things that they covered in their early stuff was PM Dawn's Set Adrift on Memory Bliss. So there's definitely this feeling that teen pop had to play to that audience a bit at the time.
Yeah, it was kind of a slow evolution moving out of that, and you get to that kind of at the end of the decade, especially with like the second NSYNC album, where you know songs start to sound like they're really like big pop blockbuster productions, and they sort of shed their R&B roots at that point. But going back to just the big songs off this album, I think that if there's one thing that kind of points the way towards what Robin would become, is that the two singles and really like everything else on the album to a lesser extent, they really pack this kind of like insane innate confidence for what was then like a 16-year-old, I think. So she was still very much a teenager making this album, but both Do You Know What It Takes and Show Me Love, they have this kind of like inherent like just forcefulness to them, and you know, kind of a desire to be heard and a no nonsense attitude to them, and like that would really kind of manifest itself later on. Is there anything else about those songs that kind of points the way to what Robin would become to you?
From the singles, I mean, I think just the general quality, like re-listening to this album, you know, the singles stand out for obvious reasons, but there's not really, you know, there's just not much filler on here. So I think that she just, I don't know what the recording process was like for her, how much creative control she had, but everything's just very tight on the record. There's not a lot of waste. There's nothing that, you know, a lot of albums, like I can't really speak to, you know, other people's takes or something, but I'm sure like things on Britney's first album would embarrass her or some other fans now, you know, and Robin, there's not a single song on here that I think she would look back on or her fans would be and be like, okay, that was kind of corny or something. Like everything sounds exactly as mature and just, you know, nothing feels like it's like punching above its weight. Like she just seems so comfortable in this TLC Mary J. Blige kind of mode, and that makes all the more astounding that she completely switched modes later and is, you know, even more well known and celebrated rightfully for that.
Yeah, well, you mentioned Britney Spears, and I think Robin, like, she does herself a really big favor here by avoiding, I think, three of, like, the biggest pratfalls that artists like Britney Spears tended to kind of get trapped in on their debut albums.
Right.
One of which is that there's no covers on it, which is kind of surprising for a new artist. Like you mentioned, even the Backstreet Boys, you know, they did the Set Adrift on Memory Bliss cover. Robin doesn't attempt any kind of, you know, way to sort of automatically insert herself into pop history by covering an established pop classic. There's no guests on the album, at least not that I can remember. And definitely...
No, I don't think so.
Yeah, definitely nothing that dates it to that period in time specifically. And Britney definitely had at least one or two of those on her debut. And there's also no, like, specific mid-90s cultural references that any songs are built around. And I'm thinking specifically of Britney Spears' Email My Heart off Baby One More Time, which...
Exactly. That's sort of what I meant. The album, the only thing that really dates it to its time is just what the production trends in pop and R&B were, and even those... there's nothing that she really wears out in her productions. There's no obvious gimmick or anything like that. I mean, it's maybe she was just never the kind of person who went for a novelty or anything like that. And you know, as a person who likes a lot of novelty songs, this isn't normally something that I think is like a good or a bad. It's just that this album is. It's very easy to see why it's exceptionally strong, even if you don't like those things, or you do have a strong opinion of those things that she avoided. So,
yeah, it's a surprisingly fluid listen, I would definitely say. But one of the most interesting songs comes towards the very end of the album, and it's one you write about a bunch in your piece, and it's the title track, which I think that if you were to point to one song on the album that would lead you to believe that this was something, that there was something more to Robin than just your average kind of run-of-the-mill not factory produced, but at least factory promoted 16-year-old pop star. It's the title track, which is the penultimate track. It has a swagger to it that even the singles are sort of lacking, and it has a smoothness to it and just this easy confidence to it. Why don't you talk a little bit more about it? Because you, I think you wrote some really good things about it.
Yeah, I mean, straight up, you know, we were just talking about how there's an artist who kind of avoids like easy gimmicks and novelties from a very early age, and yet she does this bold move at the end of the record where a record called Robin Is Here, you know, one of the more generic, you know, album titles that you would expect from a teenager who's you know, just diving into pop, there's actually a title track called that, Robin Is Here, which is the most unexpected thing on the album, and she proceeds to... you know, sing about herself in the third person as, you know, the cure for whatever's ailing you, particularly, you know, romantically. And it's just, I mean, it's not a short song either. It's not like a little, like, 1 minute snippet where she's goofing around. It's a 5.5 minute song with the same layered, you know, slinky production as the rest of the record. And it predates, like, so many things. It predates Rihanna's Sex With Me from last year, where the song is literally an advertisement for why you should have sex with Rihanna, and it predates Liz Phair, her infamous 2003 song "Rock Me," where she you know, she's dating a younger man, and she, you know, one of the funny lines in the song is "You don't even know who Liz Phair is." And so this is just so Robin just sort of inserting herself into this. And singing about how Robin is here, you know, to make everything, you know, fun and sexy and stuff. It's just so funny. She does it totally straight-faced, and it's so straight-faced that unless you actually, like, look up the lyrics on Genius, you might, like, not notice that she says things like, the sun is shining, it makes everybody horny. And this song is definitely the key to there being... you know, such a big future for her, and how she ended up being such an original in the late 2000s and 2010s as a pop singer, because you just didn't really have songs like that. I mean, you know, Britney's album has, you know, songs like Soda Pop and Email My Heart and stuff, and you can debate whether or not she sort of came out the joke with those, or even if they're taken in earnest. But yeah, Robin is very clearly you know, in on this ridiculous song, and she's playing it totally straight, and it's just a really funny, interesting song. But I'll be honest, like, I didn't even notice it. I you know, replaying this record and acquainting playing this record in the first place very, very late, you know, enjoying it, I didn't even notice this song, just because it threaded. So, I mean, I noticed it was good, but I didn't notice that she's singing about herself or these ridiculous lyrics until I was kind of, you know, told to take a look at it.
Right,
so
yeah.
It's I mean, it's the next to last track on this record from 20 years ago, and the record itself, again, like, to even, you kind of had to be told to try and play this record. The only reason why a lot of people would even know this record is because of her 2010 album Body Talk, or because of her own sort of career resurgence. Because, yeah, as we established, like, even if you were a fan of the hits at the time, there was no shortage of music that was frantically pointing for you to pay attention to it. So,
yeah, I mean, the song kind of shows up in the, I mean, there's such a self-awareness to it, and it shows up at the end of the album. It almost feels like kind of a twist ending. Like you have to go back and kind of reconsider the rest of it, because the song it's so almost meta and like postmodern, and it definitely points to Robin already winking at her own stardom, which wasn't even a thing yet. She wasn't anybody when she released this album, but the fact that she had the brazenness to make this kind of self-referential joke, but also like a really good, smooth, kind of sexy song to it too, really shows the potential that she had, and which she would go on to satisfy later in her career. So are there any other gems to be found on this album? Any other kind of super deep cuts beyond the singles and the title track that kind of show a different side of Robin, or are worth investigating for people that maybe don't know the album so well?
Well, the best song that wasn't a hit for me is that this "Do You Really Want Me" song, "Show Respect," which to me it sounds as catchy and as engaging as the two big hits. It kind of surprises me that it wasn't a big U.S. hit. Apparently it was like a top 10 hit in Sweden or something, but that's a song that really grabs me. It's got this intro with what sounds like the Mellotron at the beginning of the Beatles' Strawberry Fields Forever.
Sure.
And unexpectedly kind of turns into a, you know, mid-tempo jam. And it's, you know, she really like sings her heart out on it, and I guess it's a little surprising to me that this didn't follow the others, and also that song I mentioned earlier, "Just Another Girlfriend." I mean, it's a very mature sounding track that could have been on "Life After Death" by Biggie or Mary J. Blige album, and it's pretty, and also it's got a little grit in the breakbeat behind it. So, and there's also. One thing I didn't really mention in my piece is that the album ends with this 2.5-minute a cappella song called "I Wish," where she basically, I mean, we're talking about her R&B skills and how she didn't really utilize those later. That's probably because of the song. She just, you know, puts it all out there at once with the singing, just singing like crazy on this a cappella song. It's like a straight up like Star Search thing. I mean, she doesn't go for like the acrobatic stuff like Mariah, where she's holding like the highest note or anything, but it's definitely like a Christina Aguilera level performance without really over showing off. It's just, you know, just straight up just her skill of singing, and it's a nice little way to end the album after Robin Is Here. So yeah, there's plenty of good stuff. I mean, the first song on it, "Don't Be Right," it could have been a good song on "Crazy, Sexy, Cool."
So after this, Robin's career starts to evolve kind of exponentially. She the U.S. sort of forgets about her almost immediately afterwards, because we move on to Britney and Christina and other people like that. But she stays huge in Europe. She stays huge in Sweden. Her next two albums are, you know, 1999's "My Truth" and 2002's "Don't Stop the Music." They produce hits after hits in her home country, and they really show an evolving sound and an evolving image. And it's not really until about a decade after Robin Is Here, when she her self-titled album, which comes out in 2005 in Sweden, was released a couple years later here. That's sort of when she catches back on in the U.S. And she's got this, you know, this unbelievable confidence and comedy, and she knows just the right people to collaborate with and the right people to kind of wink at. And, you know, by the time of Body Talk in 2010, she's basically as big a pop star as you can be without actually having top 40 hits. Dancing on My Own, Call Your Girlfriend, there's songs that everybody seems to know, even if they were never actually radio hits. And she's probably one of the most revered artists, I would say, of the last 10 years in terms of, you know, iconic pop figures that don't necessarily cross over into the mainstream world. And what's interesting to me about this is that she kind of sets up a career arc that a lot of other kind of cult pop stars end up following in miniature, which is that she has these couple of kind of almost fluky pop hits really early on in her career. And then as she evolves, you know, the radio play and the mainstream sort of acclaim fades away, but she cultivates this very passionate, loyal underground audience, and she'll still, you know, she'll play festivals for the next 20 years if she wants to. And you can see that kind of play out in a much more compact time frame. People like Carly Rae Jepsen or Tinashe, and most recently Lorde, I think, who's, you know, she might never have a hit as big as Royals again, but because of Royals, everybody knows who she is, and people have to pay attention to her, and so she gets to do this kind of left field, you know, some very personal and intricate pop music that people might not pay attention to otherwise. And Robin sort of sets the accidental model for that with her career.
Yeah, totally. I mean, it's funny because that arc like stretches like back to, you know, like so many things. I mean, like, you know, like Marvin Gaye went on to do things that were nothing like his '60s. His late '60s Motown stuff, or Stevie Wonder and such. So it's like this old trope that's kind of coming back. I guess I wonder if that has anything to do with like the industry kind of realizing maybe for certain periods that they were just kind of like signing artists and dropping them after they did the one thing that they were hired to do, and that maybe the idea of fostering a career is back or something. I mean, it's a good thing either way. The fact that Carly was able to have that, or Lorde was able to have that kind of career arc in like a fraction of the time that Robin did, means that maybe Robin helped pave the way for women like that to get respect.
So thank you very much, Dan Weiss, freelance writer extraordinaire. We'll always be around. Really appreciate you coming on, Dan.
Thank you, too.
Shorty got back. Should I ask her for a dance? Hold on, there's too many in the wolf pack. And besides, dirty cash talking to her, buying her fake furs and taking her to the people. Why does this kept
Hey, hello, and welcome back to Coming Around Again. Next up, we're going to discuss a great album that nobody really talks about anymore, and that's Wyclef Jean's The Carnival, which turns 20 on Saturday, June 24th. To talk about it with us, we have Chris Martins in a rare break from his busy Billboard cover story writing schedule. What's up, Chris?
How's it going, man?
Going all right. So you mentioned to me, Chris, that you actually already talked to Wyclef once this year as a secondary for a Lucas Graham story?
Yeah, it's really, really random. It was, you know, sometimes when you're looking for secondaries, you just do a real wide net, and if you don't come up with great ideas initially, it's like, who mentioned who on Twitter?
Sure, yeah.
And awesomely, of all people, Wyclef mentioned Lucas and how much he loved that song, Seven Years, what was it called?
That's the one, yeah.
Yeah, 7 years. And so I basically, I'll admit, you know, like part of the fun of doing these cover stories is who you get to talk to in the secondaries, and sometimes like it's me trying to check off like my favorites, and in that case I was like, this is my opportunity finally to talk to Wyclef.
And did he live up to expectation? Was he everything you ever dreamed of?
Oh God, he did. I mean, he answered the phone. The best thing was he answered the phone by saying, "Word up, family," and like my 15-year-old self, like, which is the age I was when The Carnival came out, just like completely melted, and it was hard for me to recover like the actual interview. But he measured up in a lot of other ways too, where it's just like, he of course talked about how he plans on covering 7 years in his set, and which is just a very Wyclef thing. Like,
did that ever end up happening?
I don't think it has, but like, okay. But I imagine he says that a lot, and that he always means it,
sure.
Because he does. This is very much a Wyclef thing, right? It's like, see a thing that he likes musically, and then to do it, and like often to do it quite well, even if it's for an outfit. So that was there, and then he also made a strong point to remind me that the 20th anniversary of this album is indeed coming up. And
wow!
So time he was.
So he was ready for this podcast.
Yeah, so at that time he was plotting, I think there was like a February show in New York, I think celebrating the carnival,
okay.
And he was trying to tell me to do everything in my powers to get out there, and alas, I, as a Los Angeles resident, did not make it out east.
All right, so you mentioned your 15-year-old self already. I know you're a big fan of this album. Were you a big fan of this album when it came out in 1997?
Yeah, I mean, that's when it, that's absolutely, I mean, I don't want to say my fandom has faded, but I mean, if there's a peak to it, that's absolutely when it happened. Was pretty much the day it came out. I actually don't have a specific memory of like tracking it down. I probably got it out of Sam Goody, which is a
get the outdated, CD from Sam Goody, sure, yeah.
A dated record shop that dwells in malls, used to dwell in malls, that is referenced in the single from this album. But either that or like a BMG ordering service, but something outdated for sure. But anyway, yeah, I just like, I put this album on repeat, all 24 tracks of it, when I was 15, when it came out. I'd been a huge Fugees fan, and you know, I like, as everybody was, I think at that point, I mean, I think when The Score came out, I mean, God, like, what had that and AT Aliens by Outkast, it was sort of like, why bother listening to anything else? Mm-hmm. Both albums were really taking like just a super kind of wild and weird liberties with the sound and shape of rap, and it just, I don't know, but they also were like so accessible and catchy and awesome. So anyway, like, to me, I was always, you know, I've always been a music geek, and like, I'm a Liner's Notes guy, you know, so I, to me, like, Wyclef was God. I mean, yeah, like, there were, there's, you know, Lauren is a bigger star in that album or whatever, but, you know, for me, I was like, wait, Wyclef is the one that's holding this whole thing together. And so to me, like I said, the dude was a God. Yeah. So I was waiting, I was waiting for that solo Wyclef album.
Well, yeah, I mean, it's interesting to kind of look back on. I mean, obviously, the Fugees, as you mentioned, they were maybe the biggest thing in rap in 1996, and certainly for suburban white kids, they were the second coming. That album sold something like 6 million copies, and it was, you know, it had singles that were everywhere. And Wyclef was the architect of it, and it seemed like that clearly, but yet he wasn't really the star of the group. The star of the group was Lauryn Hill, who, you know, had the big vocal on "Killing Me Softly" and just kind of stole every song that she was in. And so, yeah, when this album came out, I mean, I remember being excited for it, but I also just didn't really quite know what to make of it. And especially once I actually bought it, anyway, I remember having it on cassette. You said you listened to all 24 tracks like on repeat. I maybe made it through the entire thing twice. I don't know, once or twice. Not a lot. But you know, the Fugees were, they, you know, the Score was their last album. But in 1997, they were still an enormous cultural force. They were on a whole bunch of soundtracks, both together and in solo. And then when Wyclef dropped the Carnival, it did feel like it was still part of this huge moment. But I'm not really sure that the public knew what to make of him apart from the rest of the group. It's kind of like an unfiltered sort of sprawling vision where it's clear that this guy was the brains behind the operation, but without the other two members to balance him, it seemed like it wasn't a sure thing that he was going to be a star in his own right.
Right. That's totally true. I think for my level of nerdiness, it was clear to me that he was the star of my little Fugees play, in my own mind. But that's obviously not reality. But I think, like, I guess what I would say is that, you know, he did in a way position himself as the co-star at all times, right? Because this album, I mean, yes, this album is his album, and it's called Wyclef Jean Presents the Carnival, the actual title of the album. But that's literally everything he's ever been involved with. I mean, like, it's always Wyclef Jean Presents. Like, I mean, if you think about, like, yeah, Killing Me Softly, of course, it's Lauren's song, but, like, Wyclef's albums on that are fantastic. I mean, he like, brings in this certain pacing and, like, an interplay that, like, seems to tease more out of whoever's on the song. It's like if DJ Khaled had the voice of an angel, then, like, plus could like drop bars.
Yeah, no, that's totally fair. I think that the DJ Khaled comparison isn't even a totally inaccurate one, and he does kind of seem on this record like yeah, he's on most tracks, if not every track, but it does seem like he's more the director of the proceedings than the kind of overwhelming, like, single-minded artist who really, like, is putting himself front and center. And the really cool thing about this album, I think the reason why, like, I found it so refreshing to come back to in the last couple of years more so, is that, like, its worldview is just enormous. Like, the universe of this album, beyond even who's on it, it just encompasses so much. There's different cultures, there's different languages, and there's even like a very kind of open-ended dialogue between different generations of music going on in this album. And like it's so much fun to listen to because it sounds like somebody who's like kind of perpetually falling in love with music over and over again with each song.
Yeah, I completely agree. I mean, I think that if you take out the sketches, and I think we'll probably wind up talking a little bit more about sketches. But if you take those out, you kind of have three albums or three EPs, really. Like, kind of, I feel like one is sort of the third Fugees LP that never came out. You know, I mean, even if Kronos and Lauren are barely on the album, but songs like Apocalypse and Year of the Dragon, which has Lauryn Hill on it, I mean, they're very much like the score part two. But then there's like this, like the guitar loving, crooning, like cooing Wyclef, who's actually worthy of hosting people like the Neville Brothers on a song like Mona Lisa. I mean, which is just this incredible collision of what you're talking about, where it's generational and cultural, just this bizarre magic that actually works so well. I mean, the Neville Brothers, I don't think have ever sounded so good on modern production or contemporary to that day production, I should say. Or the fact that, like, there's a song, I mean, what's it called, Gunpowder, where he's singing Back by the I-3s, which is Bob Marley and the Wailers backing singers, not to mention Marley's wife, Rita.
Right, yeah.
And he's great. I mean, like, there's no secret that Wyclef, like, I don't know, as a kid, like, I grew up with Bob Marley stan. My dad raised me up a ton of Marley. And, like, I always just wanted Wyclef to make, like, that album with him and his guitar, and I don't think he ever did, but on songs like that, it's just stunning. And again, and then there's the third aspect, which is like this little like Haitian Creole EP tacked onto it, mostly at the end, but there's also the song Fais-y song that's like in the middle or toward this, you know, I don't know, last third of the album. And that's like, you know, when it came out, it was certainly music unlike anything I'd ever heard, and I really don't think it was like anything else that was happening, because it was this strange hybrid of like rap and reggae and rock and Haitian rah-rah music and R&B and acoustic and soul. And then, of course, again, it's just like, you've got the Neville's, you've got him remaking a Bee Gees song, you've got him remaking a Willie Nelson song, you've got him remaking a Celia Cruz song with Celia Cruz on it. Later on, he's working with Paul Simon like, and Bono and Tom Jones. But also, like, now he's working with Young Thug, Wyclef came from rap, but that might as well be a world apart from the rap world that he came from. But coming back to the carnival, it completely does, you know, sort of just take all these things and mash them up. And I think, and so deftly, in a way that, again, like, it may be... it's very 90s, right, to combine all this stuff. But, like, it's done... very tastefully, surprisingly so. And I think in revisiting this album, a lot of that holds up, and it doesn't sound so much like the Loud Rocks compilation where like people from Wu-Tang were like recording with like Smash Mouth or whatever that was. It really just sounds great. And I think just as one further point, like, that, you know, the Fugees were obviously like such a New York group, but in a way that is so inclusive, because, you know, they had such an immigrant sound, but also like such a native New York energy. And like, it just, I think in hindsight, and listening to a Wyclef album, you realize like what a steady and restraint the score was, because here, like, all that stuff, all those influences, the Latin stuff, the African stuff, like the Caribbean, it just explodes.
Yeah, it just comes pouring out, sort of. You talk about the album kind of being three separate entities in one, and I think you can almost see that in miniature with the three singles on the album, at least a couple of which you already sort of alluded to, which are We Trying to Stay Alive, which was the kind of redo of the Bee Gees Stayin' Alive from Saturday Night Fever, and had the Saturday Night Fever like video, and the Celia Cruz remake, Guantanamero, that which said actually has Celia Cruz on it, and then Gone Till November, the third single, which is a sort of a very almost traditional pop rock song, a ballad, an acoustic ballad. And you kind of get like the, you know, the Stayin' Alive is kind of the Fugees redo, because, you know, I think Praz is on that song, Jean Forte's on that song. And then Guantanamero is him kind of exploring his, you know, his roots. And Gone Till November is just him making an amazing pop song. Do you have a favorite among those three singles?
Yeah, I mean, I guess, boy, at the time, I think Guantanamero is beautiful, but I don't know that it was ever in my favorites on the album. But
it was a strange choice for second single, certainly.
Yeah, yeah. Of the singles, really, God, it was kind of tied for me between the two, Stay Alive and Gone Till November. I think, like, I guess I have qualms with trying to stay alive. Not in that, that have nothing to do with my enjoyment of it. Like, it's a super fun, super cool song, and I think going back to it, I still enjoy it. Mm-hmm. But part of me almost wishes it didn't exist, because I kind of think it gave Wyclef, like, license to go down a path of trying to do these weird pop crossover moments that I think ultimately sort of diluted his brand and sometimes made him seem a little corny.
The Diddy path, right?
Yeah, exactly. And it's really, you know, a song like We're Trying to Stay Alive. I mean, look, my nostalgia for that may be blinding me, but I actually don't think that's a corny song. Like, no. It could have gone really corny, like simple Bee Gees, or basically remaking a Bee Gees song and turning it into a rap track. But I think it's a really, really cool song. But that's such a tough type to keep walking down. And I think, like, later on when he does a song with The Rock, which is kind of ridiculous. And hindsight now, I'm like, I kind of enjoy the ridiculousness of it, but, like, still not a great look. And then the song later on with Tom Jones, and I don't know, it's sort of, he kind of plays himself, to quote Khaled.
Always comes back to Khaled.
And then Gone Till November, man, I mean, I actually was surprised to realize in preparing for Wikipedia and the charts and stuff that Gone Till November was the bigger song, because it's a really pretty, and I guess you said it is more of a traditional, like, kind of rock ballad or whatever, but it does have rap verses, and it's a really pretty song, a really unique sounding song. It's powered by Wyclef's voice, which is great, and also the New York Philharmonic, so it's sort of surprising that was the bigger track, and I love it. Like, really into that side of Wyclef.
Yeah, it's definitely between those two for me. I think I actually might give the edge to We Trying to Stay Alive. I mean, I keep expecting to go back to that song and kind of, like, be confronted with what you're talking about, where it's just like, oh, this is so corny, this is such a 1997 way to structure a hit. But, like, man, that song has a strut to it. It just bursts through the door, and it's unstoppable. I never get sick of that song, really.
But I agree 100%.
Yeah, but Gone Till November is definitely the accomplishment song on that album, and I got a shout out to that video, especially for, like, the 2 seconds where Wyclef says, and knocking on heaven's door like I'm Bob Dylan, and Bob Dylan actually shows up just, like, sitting in the airport next to him.
So, yes,
that's definitely one of the more indelible memories from that album cycle. But so beyond the singles, are there any, like, deep cuts or like little moments on the album that really stuck with you 20 years later?
Oh man, I mean. I'll try to keep it limited. Absolutely. I mean, I think the first real song in the Apocalypse is really cool. It's so eerie. It has that opera sample, and then the bass kicks in really hard, and it's Wyclef planting his flag at the top of this album mountain. I also think, the one I mentioned, the Lauryn Hill's on Year of the Dragon, is just a killer post boom bap banger, and, like, very much in the Fugees mold.
Awesome beat on that song.
Again, the song with the Neville Brothers, Mona Lisa, which is a throwback to the very first Fugees album. That song is just gorgeous. It's slinky, it's sexy. They just sound incredible over his production. But again, I was completely raised on Bob Marley and such a Marley fan. So for me, there's just kind of nothing better than Gunpowder. It's a beautiful song. And sort of it's kind of the spiritual sequel to the Fugees doing No Woman, No Cry. It's very much conceptually, tonally, almost the same song, but it's his own version of it, and it just is so, so pretty. I love it so much.
Only thing I have to add to that is that I just love that there's multiple moments on this album where either he or Lauren make reference to how the Knicks keep losing in the playoffs. So it's a very real thing for a late 90s East Coast rap album to keep kind of harping on, and I just love that. That's all the stuff that we kind of love about the album. At the time, it was a moderate hit. You know, I saw that it actually peaked at number 16 both on the Billboard 200 and on the year-end Village Voice Paz and Jop poll. So, like, decently commercially successful, decently critically acclaimed. But I do feel like the album's kind of been forgotten in the 20 years since. And you know, that part of it is because parts of the album don't really hold up so well. Part of it might be that Wyclef's kind of seen as a cad a little bit in the stuff that's come out about the way he and Lauren split up. So what do you think is the reason that, like, more than anything else, that maybe this album hasn't held up as well in the public esteem?
Man, it's kind of tough. I guess my view is very very colored by the fact that I was just such a Wyclef fan in that era. And you know, again, for me, it was like number one out of, you know, the Fugees. Mm-hmm. But like, I don't know. I think he sort of diluted his legacy a little bit. I think now nobody's too worried about him doing that further. But I think maybe after the success to Stayin' Alive reboot, I think he just, I don't know. I think he diluted his legacy with Thirst and sort of strange collabo situations. I'm all for taking those chances, and I bless him for doing it, but I think sometimes it's come across a little bit grabby. And who knows what that might be. I mean, probably is very much tied with, like, how we all view the Fugees, and really the fact that Lauren is sort of you know, excuse the phrase, but the male genius of the group, and Praz was a great voice, and he was fun to listen to, but his vision never panned out. It never panned out as having much of a vision worth speaking of. And I think, you know, I think Wyclef might have at least at some point had a chip on his shoulder, in the same way that I do on his behalf, which is that, like, man, like, he held that whole thing together, and again, it only really mattered for one album, right? The score, but like, what an album that was, and what an amazing moment. Like, he could make Praz like really seem like somebody we should care about.
I still love the sound of Praz's voice, man. I maybe he didn't really have the word play abilities on his own, but right, man, he added something to the Fugees that I feel like he's never still really gotten credit for. But
I'm with you on that. I'm with you on that. And then they also, I mean, and I never want to take away from what Lauryn Hill's been able to do in her career. And obviously, in this education, Lauryn Hill is a wonderful album. I don't know a whole lot about the behind the scenes on that. But, like, I feel like with the score, like, he gave Lauryn's genius, like, a really good framework. Sure. And I don't mean that he's responsible for her genius, but I think it all just, they balance each other, and they balanced out his, you know, weird inclinations. So, I don't know. I think left on his own, he may have felt like he really needed to show and prove that he's the genius that nobody was, or maybe not enough people were in a rush to say he was.
Yeah, that's all fair. Definitely, the critical respect for Wyclef kind of declined the longer his career went on, and some of the collaborations got, yeah, as you say, more and more thirsty, and yeah, I'd even forgotten about some of them that I was looking at the list earlier today. And now he gets into the EDM era the last couple years. I think there's a song with Afrojack. I'm like, so some of it works, some of it really doesn't. You appreciate they're still taking a shot, but it's definitely diminishing returns at a certain point. But
I think it also, sorry, I didn't mean to cut you off, but I would say that you're going to bring this up, that, you know, again, also skits, album skits don't really age well. I mean, the very common of them in the first place don't really age well, even people still do them sometimes, they insist upon it. But in hindsight, they just never hold up, and this album, this album is sort of, like, framed by this court case where Wyclef is being tried as a player, a bad influence, and a GD revolutionary. which I kind of like. It's very much of a time. It's funny, but it is problematic.
It borders on the offensive in a numerous different ways.
Yeah, I mean, there's a character named Down Low Ho, which is just as bad of a racist Asian caricature as Long Duck Dong with 16 Candles. It's really horrible. There's another one that's kind of ugly. It's just, I think it's a sketch that's meant to skewer how quickly police suspect black men of doing terrible things, which is absolutely fair, but it also implies that women are prone to crying raped, and that's like a hateful, horrifying myth, and I just do not want to hear that on an album that I love.
It's right in the middle of the album, too, and it really takes the air out of it.
Yeah, it's really, really gnarly. And yeah, and then just the length. Yeah, the fact that it's 24 tracks, and 9 of those are skits or interludes. That's just kind of insane. but we have the benefit now of putting together and editing our playlist quite easily.
Very true.
And if you cut out those 9 tracks, you get over 10 minutes of the album off of it, which is lovely. So it ends up being 15 songs in like 60 minutes. So it's not too bad in hindsight.
So yeah, we're talking a little bit about kind of his diminishing influence over the years, his diminishing importance, at least. Are there artists out today that you kind of see either as parallels to Wyclef, or like people who are obviously indebted to him in some way, and anywhere where you kind of see the spirit of Wyclef being kept alive in 2017?
Yeah, I would say the spirit is there. I don't know necessarily the direct influences, but I mean, honestly, I almost think anyone interesting coming at rap now has a little bit of Wyclef spirit in them, whether they know it or not. And I think, you know, they may not have... I mean, the big difference is, right, this younger generation has been streaming all music ever since they were old enough to click.
Mm-hmm.
And that collapsed the generations and muddles genres, you know, handily and messily. The difference with Wyclef, I think, was precision and finesse, and just his sort of obvious reverence for musical history and his own musical training. Obviously, he's a really great guitar player. But guys like Young Thug or Yachty or whomever, you know, they're coming at rap from weird angles. They're incorporating outside genre tropes and, you know, and just melding, mixing up all types of rap and music, and it comes out the way it does. I think it makes sense. I don't know who figured it out, but that like Wyclef and Young Thug cross-pollinated on each other's last cycles.
it wasn't a crazy moment, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, it wasn't necessarily like the best result ever, but like, I don't know, it's still kind of cool that it happened. And I think, you know, somebody else that's come up that is somewhat a modern analog would be Khaled.
Okay.
Without the incredible singing voice or the bars or the guitar play.
Besides that, yeah.
A lot of the other artistic stuff that Wyclef is known for. You know, Khaled is referenced in my recent cover story on him. He's certainly more Diddy than Wyclef, but he also has a deep reverence for music and the music that he loves, and a desire to bridge genres and to bridge artists, and also to position himself as sort of the loving puppet master, which again, like, presented by Wyclef, Jean. Like, I mean, everything
for sure
that Wyclef has done very much has a stamp on it, and, you know, he's not out there yelling, another one, but he's doing something, you know, something to put a stamp on it, for sure.
Yeah. Did you ever get to listen to the Jidenna album, The Chief?
Not in depth, I have to admit.
That's one, like, it didn't occur to me at the time when I was listening to it. It's a really good album, and thinking about it in kind of the context of Wyclef the last month or so, like, it's another guy. He's got a very clear but very expansive vision. He's hip-hop. He's not totally hip-hop, and he has his ears open to a whole bunch of different genres, and especially when he does kind of reggae-influenced songs on that album, it really kind of echoes some of the stuff that Wyclef was doing on the Carnival. Yeah, and I don't know for a fan. I don't know for a fact that he's a fan of Wyclef, but I bet you Wyclef would be a fan of his if he heard that album.
Yeah, I'm sure Wyclef has heard it, and Wyclef is already working on the remix or the remake or the collab.
He's going to cover Classic Man in his next concert. and we'd probably be remiss to not mention Wild Thoughts, the new song by Khaled and Rihanna. And
yes.
Bryson Tiller actually too, although his part's sort of negligible compared to the other two. And that song, it samples Maria Maria, which was a Santana song from the very beginning of the millennium. That, you know, it's a Santana song, but it's really a Wyclef song, and it's featuring his singing group, the Product GNB. But, you know, he's doing those ad libs on it, and that song could have slotted onto the Carnival pretty easily, right?
Oh yeah, absolutely, like 100%. I mean, I'd argue that whole Santana album, what was that album called?
Supernatural.
What was it? Supernatural?
Yeah, it sold some like 16 million copies in an insane moment in music history.
Right, yeah. I mean, I owned it for sure. I think I kept it probably like 3 years, but I owned it. I mean, I'd argue that a lot of the ideas on there could, you know, there are of a piece with the sort of world that Wyclef lives in. But yeah, Maria Maria is absolutely a Wyclef song. It feels like it. You know it from the beginning, really. And I think it's really It's really awesome. I'm kind of excited to hear it again with new people singing on it. it even has the guitar solo in it, which is amazing. It's like I haven't actually done a side by side, but I kind of don't want to. Like, I don't want to know how close the original it is or how different it is. But I love that it's here again, and I'm probably because it's testament to the idea that, like, hey, maybe we should tune back into the carnival. Maybe those songs have aged just fine, and maybe we are at another point where, it's not necessarily going to be the kind of overstated rap and rock hybrids of the late 90s into the early 2000s, but, like, we're at another point where music is really, really meshing and melding and mixing a lot, and, I think, like, pop ears or radio ears are more than primed to hear the kind of stuff that Wyclef has been churning out for decades now, I guess.
Yeah, totally. And I gotta say, I haven't even formed an opinion on Wild Thoughts yet, because I'm just going back and listening to Maria Maria, like, just remembering what a great song that is, and what a great Wyclef song. It's just another, like, cross generation, cross genre. It's just a absolute knockout hook. Like, nobody does it better than Wyclef, and it's good that Cali gave the people a reason to remember that. Chris Martins, thank you so much for coming on. Get back to work on that cover story, and hope to talk to you again soon.
Thanks, Andrew. Great to be here. Talk to you soon.
It is Ryan here, and I have a question for you. What do you do when you win? Like, are you a fist pumper, a woo-hooer, a hand clapper, a high-fiver? I kind of like the high-five, but if you want to hone in on those winning moves, check out Chumba Casino. At ChumbaCasino.com, choose from hundreds of social casino-style games for your chance to redeem serious cash prizes. There are new game releases weekly, plus free daily bonuses, so don't wait. Start having the most fun ever at ChumbaCasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18+.